From Community Public Radio, this is CPR Sunday. In New York, I'm Don DeBar.
And this week, we speak with Eric Dreitzer, political commentator and host of the website StopImperialism.org.
Okay, Eric, so we're going to summarize the last 5 weeks, I guess, of review of the U.S., European Union, whatever, imperialism's revanche against the rise of an alternate or of alternate possibilities, particularly as presented by the BRICS.
Yeah, exactly. And to my great shame, I've fallen behind on writing my series of articles. I still have three more to go, and they will be coming in the coming weeks.
But
man, news has been moving fast these last couple of weeks. I'm struggling to keep up. But yes, exactly. And again, to answer some, maybe I would like to start just with this brief aside to answer some critics who have voiced their concerns about this issue. I would just like to point out nobody is suggesting that BRICS is somehow anti-capitalist, okay? It's not that. What it is, however, is presenting an alternative to global hegemony of Wall Street, the City of London, and the imperial establishment.
Right.
And I think that distinction is important because if you look at the various parts of the world that have tried to break away from the empire, they have needed some kind of an alternative infrastructure, alternative economic and political architecture. And I think that is really the space that BRICS and these other non-Western institutions are beginning to inhabit. And that's why they're so dangerous to the West.
Yeah, you know, let me go there for a minute, too, because not, you know, it was one thing you had before, you know, the so-called Red Menace or whatever. You had the Soviet Union. You had the Warsaw Pact countries. You had China. You had Cuba. You know, maybe a half dozen other countries in the world that weren't really tied together into any serious political or economic, union outside of the ones we just described. And inside of that, you had the Soviet Union and China, both in an ideological struggle and certainly not in any type of economic or military cooperation.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a world where capitalism was still expanding and providing a good number of people, not the people who were under imperialism's boot on the outside, but inside, at least a possibility of a comfortable living. So not necessarily an attractive alternative to many people in the West. Now you have basically other people who say, you know what, you want to make a business deal with them with a gun at your head? Guess what? Make a business deal with us and we'll make more money together. That's more of a threat.
Yeah, in many ways it is more of a threat. And I think it's important, this distinction that we're both drawing here, the difference between an ideological alternative and a substantive economic alternative. And this is, of course, not to say that anybody who considers themselves a socialist or an anti-capitalist or, you know, what have you, that we should, you know, uphold the BRICS as, you know, the utopian form of, you know, political and economic organization. It's obviously not that. But in this, in the world that we live in and in the environment that we have in the post-Cold War period, BRICS and Shanghai Cooperation Organization and the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, China's One Belt, One Road, Russia's Eurasian Economic Union, all of these things taken in their totality, I think represent a significant shift away from a singular monocentric world in which the power is entirely 100% concentrated in Wall Street and City of London finance capital and their political arms in Washington, in London, in Brussels, and so forth. And I think that that's really the crux of what we're talking about here, not utopianism, but rather the reality of 2016.
And, you know, also for those that are looking at, you know, building socialism in the world, first of all, the space for that is has taken place on the ground in every place, not in every place, but every place that it has taken place. has been a place that first had to wrangle itself from outside of the control of exactly that monolith. Yep. And this new structure is accommodating all types of political and economic systems.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, it's interesting, not to belabor this too much, because I know we have a lot to talk about, but it is interesting to note that what I would call, you know, utopian view, or rather, maybe we should say, purely ideological view, wherein anything that is not 100%, you know, socialist, according to whatever socialist perspective one has, is automatically, you know, accommodating global capitalism. And I don't really see it that way. I think that there are nuances to be made in the way that we view, say, neoliberal finance capital versus the kind of capitalism, say, practiced by China or even by other countries in Latin America, Brazil being a good example of that. So, you know, I think that we have to take a more nuanced perspective on this. And that's why, to bring it back here, that's why I think the attack on the BRICS individually and then from the broader perspective, you know, collectively, is such a significant struggle going on right now.
Okay, so let's go back and review some of what we've looked at and then try to figure out what lessons we've learned.
Well, and what developments we've seen since you and I spoke, I guess it was like 4 weeks ago now, has been major developments in Brazil. The soft coup against Dilma Rousseff and the Workers' Party is continuing full pace. And in fact, now we are facing the very real possibility, sad though it may be, that Rousseff's government could be forcibly removed. Well, forcibly might not be the right word, not necessarily in a military style coup, but could be removed through legal, quote unquote, means. You know, the parliament is now pushing forward. I think the vote was more or less like 2/3 in favor of impeachment against Dilma Rousseff. Now, impeachment meaning, of course, bringing the legal proceedings into the houses of government, not removing her from office necessarily.
Right.
But that is, I think, a very significant development, because now it's no longer just the manufacturing of street protests and the calls for an impeachment. Now we're looking at a full-blown legal process that is going to take place. But of course, the question is, and this is also interesting, is that since we first started talking about this, Don, we've had the Panama Papers come out.
Right.
Key members of the so-called opposition in Brazil are all implicated in corruption as well. I think it was all but what I saw a statistic, which is really, I think, indicative and illustrative of what we're talking about here. All but one of the parliamentarians in Brazil that voted in favor of impeaching Dilma Rousseff are implicated in corruption charges. All but one. So, you know, it's incredible that we would sit here and talk about them going after Rousseff for corruption that she directly is not even involved in, and trying to remove her from office when almost every single one of these people is clearly, in a very documented way, engaged in large-scale corruption of various kinds.
Yeah, well, and also, the actual charge that's going through, and before people get too excited out there, the expectation is, although that certainly could change, is that this is going to be stopped dead in the Senate if it gets there. But the interesting thing is that the charge itself that's making its way through the process is essentially a charge that, in order to balance the budget, because they had a shortfall in a program that they were using to take care of hungry, poor people, they misstated Petrobras revenues as being in the government's pocket. It's money that would have gotten there anyway, but they used some bookkeeping finessing to allow them to budget that money and disperse it to people that needed it. It wasn't like they found that she spent it on a Porsche for her daughter or anything like that.
Yeah, and look, the bottom line is that ultimately we understand what this is really about. This is about manufacturing a corruption scandal in order to remove a government that is in various ways not beholden to the same interests that traditionally the Brazilian government has been. And look, I mean, anybody who knows even the basics of the history of Brazil going back into the 19th century, back into the days when Brazil was the world leader in slavery, in exploitative economic oppression, knows that the government and the economy of that country has been all seemingly from time immemorial in the hands of a wealthy elite that have controlled that country, that have controlled the resources. And when they see a government of the Workers' Party, with all of its flaws, by the way, we shouldn't pretend like the party and the government is somehow, you know, perfect in every way, that they haven't engaged in their own, you know, finagling and profit seeking and all of the rest of that. They've done a lot of that. But the substantive and qualitative difference between the Workers' Party and previous governments is that they don't entirely answer to Brazil's elite. They answer to the masses of working and poor people. That's why they're carried to victory in these elections. When you look at the breakdown demographically and regionally in Brazil's elections, you can see where their base of support is. It's the working people, it's the poor in the Northeast, in the cities, in the slums, and so forth. So this is really what they're responding to. And again, we have to take a broad perspective here. It is no different. It's only slightly different, but really there's very little difference between what you've seen in Brazil and what you've seen in Venezuela and what you've seen in Bolivia and in Nicaragua. What I mean is that the right-wing elites, who are typically light-skinned, who identify themselves with Europe and with the United States, with North America, with global capital, with the, you know, outside world, not only do they look down on working and poor people, they have a very distinctly racist view of them. You know, what do they call Maduro in Venezuela? Maduro the burro, Maduro the donkey. They called Chavez a monkey, a gorilla, an ape. There are racial stereotypes, and of course, classist is, you know, goes without saying, right, stereotypes that they use, and they do the same in Brazil, a vehemently racist country that has a very deeply racist past. And they also identify the Workers' Party, Dilma Rousseff, Lula, and the rest of them with the blacks. They identify them with the favelas. They identify them with everything that they abhor. And this is, again, to use a word that I don't always love to use, the intersectionality between race and class. And that has a lot to do with the hate that you see spewed against the Workers' Party.
Yeah, and it, with the U.S. acting out to meddle in that kind of stuff, this is the technology that they have, you know, more or less pioneered around the globe. So Brazil was very fertile ground for that particular type of attack.
Yeah, and Brazil has a very, as I mentioned, a very checkered past when it comes to pun not intended, a very checkered past when it comes to issues of race. And, you know, there's that iconic picture of the Brazilians, light-skinned Brazilians, draped in the Brazilian flag on their way to a protest to demand the ouster of Dilma Rousseff, and they're trailed by their dark-skinned nanny pushing their child in a stroller. And I think in many ways that kind of image illustrates exactly what I'm talking about, this sort of intersection between race and class and how that translates into political power. So when you see in the Western media or in the right-wing media in Brazil or in Latin America, you see these images of these protests demanding that Rousseff be removed from office, you have to understand who is mobilizing for that and what they really represent. I think in many ways they represent the most deeply reactionary kind of politics that exists exists in Latin America, one that sees the greatness of their country and the greatness of their region in relation, in a subordinate role to U.S. imperialism, to Western imperialism, rather than how Chavez saw it, how the Bolivarian process sees it as actually quite the opposite, breaking out of that past and establishing an independent future for the region. And ultimately, I think that is what this struggle is about, the past versus the future.
Yeah. I mean, that iconic image, quote unquote, made me think of Uptown Manhattan, actually, but Upper West Side or Upper East Side.
Yeah.
And also, though, there's some important things for people that aren't familiar with Brazil's history to note. One very important thing that you brought up, that you mentioned, is the significance of the transatlantic slave trade there. It was the big center of it, and it has the largest African population in the Western, African descended population in the Western Hemisphere as well. Larger than the United States. Right.
And slavery lasted longer there.
That's right.
Slavery is a more recent phenomenon in Brazil than it even is in the United States.
Right.
Now, I mean, it was the 19th century, but I mean, it was almost the end of the 19th century. And the economic distribution in Brazil, I mean, even worse than the U.S., where you had, the cotton kingdom and the cotton plantations, you're talking about, hundreds of thousands of acres for each ranch that was owned by a single individual, right? I mean, you're talking about the most inequitable distribution of land and resources probably anywhere in the world was Brazil. And that is the history from which Brazil is emerging. And that goes back to what I was saying earlier about the racialization of this issue as well. To identify politically a party with the poor and working people is to identify them as the enemy of white privilege, of white skin.
Yeah, and to understand the soil in which that grew up, if you look at the development of the mother country there, the mother country for Brazil, of course, was Portugal. Mm-hmm. And Portugal, it was only, 1970 that it threw off a fascist government?
Yeah, exactly. And in many ways, what Portugal is going through now is actually quite indicative of some of the similar things that we're seeing in Brazil. And those elites in Brazil, they see themselves just as in many ways, for instance, the elites in Venezuela see themselves in relation to Spain and in relation to the United States. Right. The elites in Brazil see themselves in relation to Portugal, in relation to the United States, not in relation to their fellow Brazilians who are lower on the socioeconomic ladder.
Right. So that we have that going there. And then we have Russia.
Yeah, and just to finish that point, I just want to make the larger point here. What we're seeing in Brazil is directly connected to what we're seeing in Venezuela, what we're seeing in Argentina, what we're seeing really throughout Latin America.
What we saw in Honduras and Paraguay, which are the same phenomenon, just with different techniques as applied locally.
Exactly. And if you think about it, what is the larger trajectory of all of this? From the time that Chavez came to power in 1998, 1999, you saw a push towards real independence in Latin America, breaking away from the United States, from the Yankee Empire, and really forging an independent path in the world, and specifically a regional integration path. At that time, and especially into the Bush administration, the United States in the wake of 9/11 particularly was so focused on the Middle East, so focused on, the war in Iraq and all of the rest of that, that in many ways they allowed Latin America, not because they wanted it to, but just by virtue of this is how it went, they allowed Latin America to kind of move in this leftward progressive direction. And actually, since Obama's come into power, we have seen a real strong pushback against Latin America. Right. As you mentioned, 2009, not long after Obama takes office, you have a right-wing coup in Honduras, orchestrated to a large extent by the current presidential frontrunner, Hillary Clinton. You see similarly in Venezuela, in Brazil, in Argentina, in Ecuador, all of these countries that had moved to the left, you see a strong push from the right. And again, that is, I think, the broad narrative that needs to be understood, because just in the last year, 18 months, the right wing has reestablished itself as the dominant political force in Argentina under President Macri. The right wing has re-emerged as a major political force in Venezuela in the National Assembly under economic crisis conditions. Similarly, the right wing is attempting to reassert itself in Bolivia, right, as Evo Morales, under very, I would say, questionable circumstances, lost this referendum vote in Bolivia to extend his term and to amend the constitution. So that means we can expect a right-wing resurgence in Bolivia perhaps as well. So we see it all over the region, this pushback against the leftward momentum of the last 15 years, the so-called pink revolutions, right? The pink movement, the pink progressivism, whatever you want to call it. That is, I think, the grand narrative for the region. And unfortunately, and this is really one of the shortcomings of BRICS and of these non-Western institutions, unfortunately, for a variety of reasons, they have been unable and or unwilling to really prop up and to provide the necessary support for the left in Latin America.
And of course, they were so busy dealing with the Middle East that they allowed Southcom to not operate in Latin America or the Caribbean until around 2008, when they reestablished it and built it out in 2010.
And isn't it interesting that all of this is done under a so-called Democratic president, right? Yep, under a so-called progressive U.S. president. Of course, any thinking person knows Obama's no progressive, but that is at least how it's presented. And again, this, I think, and I know we're not talking U.S. politics today, but this returns us to this question that, you know, Glenn Ford of Black Agenda Report has always brought up endlessly, that Obama is the more effective evil, not the lesser evil, the more effective evil. And effective for imperialism means being able to undermine, destabilize, and ultimately destroy, or at least that's the attempt, the left in Latin America, what Bush could never do.
And that effectiveness primarily resting on their ability to not face massive opposition at home, like
exactly,
if it were a Republican.
Yes, exactly.
It's like an only Nixon could go to China moment. And there's another point that's underlined on this before we move on, which is that in each case, in the case of the reestablishment of Southcom and in Africa with the establishment of AFRICOM, they actually were implemented on paper in Bush's last year by the Bush administration and then seamlessly implemented, effectively implemented by Obama, as if it were exactly one administration.
Yeah, well, that's right. And let's not forget that Obama kept Bush's last Secretary of Defense in power. Yeah. Robert Gates really was, I don't know that it has ever happened where a president, or at least not in recent memory, where a president, a new administration comes into power and they literally keep the same cabinet minister, the same, Secretary of Defense. And so you want to talk about a seamless transition for the military industrial complex, right, for the imperial establishment. That is really the epitome of a seamless transition. And you're absolutely right. AFRICOM established in 2007, but, you know, thanks to the reporting of, you know, Nick Turse in particular, he deserves a lot of credit for it, but he's not the only one. Actually, although I almost never do it, the Washington Post reporter, whose name is escaping me just at this moment, who has done a lot of good work covering AFRICOM all throughout the African continent, all of this documents that actually AFRICOM has become this massive force with a massive footprint, although it's not, you know, really seen on paper, all over Africa. America is really under the Obama administration, and Obama has really reasserted U.S. imperial influence all throughout Africa using this this large, you know, archipelago of bases and what they don't call bases, you know, security, cooperative security facilities and strategic, you know, outposts and drone facilities and what have you. All of that has taken place under Obama. So Latin America, Africa, Southeast Asia, all of these places have seen a reassertion of U.S. power under the so-called progressive president.
Yeah. And just for clarification, to harmonize the dates here, and we're both right, Gates announced to the Senate Armed Services Committee February 6, 2007, that Bush gave authority to create AFRICOM. The new director of AFRICOM's transition team arrived in Stuttgart to begin creating the framework for it. In September, the Senate confirmed William E. Ward as AFRICOM's first commander, and then in October of 2008, the command separated from the US-EUCOM and began operating as its own unit. So.
Yeah, right on the verge of Obama's election. So, right. Yep. it is quite literally the seamless transition.
Yeah, it was a setup. Here you go. Okay, this is the guy we need to go sell it to Africa. And yeah, it makes you ponder whether, you know, if you think back, because they set the team to plan this. They set it up in mid-2006 when Rumsfeld formed a planning group to do this. At that time, nobody knew who Obama was. It's a hell of a coincidence that we get, quote-unquote, America's first black president, right as AFRICOM is, you know, set up as a unit. And then, okay, go ahead. Now we have to go put the U.S. military back in Africa.
Yeah, and again...
And a son of a Kenyan, no less.
Right, and the elephant in the room, so to speak, in regards to all of that is, of course, China. This is the moment in which the United States, mm-hmm. Really in the second half of the Bush administration, really began to understand the scope of what China was doing in Africa. You know, China's large-scale investment into Africa begins roughly, and this is just, you know, for historical purposes, roughly around the year 2000. But it escalates exponentially. Essentially, one could say, maybe not as exponentially,
apparently.
But in a large sense, it escalates all throughout the first half of that decade. And then by 2004, 2005, China's investment in Africa becomes something that can't be ignored, despite the fact the U.S. is bogged down in this horrific war in Iraq, despite the fact that the U.S. policy had really had a blind spot to a large extent in Africa. They begin to see the importance of reasserting U.S. military control throughout Africa in order to counter China's economic penetration. And from that point to now, that has really been the great story in Africa, U.S. military versus Chinese economic engagement. And AFRICOM is in many ways sort of the leading edge of that conflict.
You know, so in October of 2009, I'm walking around Tripoli, Libya, and I'm seeing cranes all over the place like it's Houston in the 1980s or something, and there are all these construction companies, Chinese, Korean, and walk around the shops are full, the shops have all the same stuff that we have in Walmart, the same exact stuff, and we know where that is purchased. Now, when you had a condition where China, you know, the whole arrangement with the United States got set up and implemented, all the factories left the United States and went to China manufacturing stuff so cheaply that even the people that don't have jobs anymore here in the United States can buy it. China makes a boatload of money, starts looking around the world to invest it, invests it in Africa. Well, they were looking at a point now. I'm sitting here looking at both this huge investment being made and also the oil being shipped out of Libya, that oil going to Western oil companies, being sold to China through those, etc., of China perhaps looking at Africa and saying, let's cut out the middleman and starting to go direct. We no longer have to have these things manufactured in an American partly owned factory in China, take that money, sell it to Americans, take that money, invest it in Africa. Let's just sell the stuff directly to Africans and take their oil directly. And who the hell needs those guys? That is a real threat.
Yeah, exactly. And actually, to bring it forward, because just to illustrate that we're not talking about a purely historical relationship, just this past week, you had a major deal signed between the government of Nigeria and the Chinese government. And specifically, this has to do with the exchange and debt settlement in Chinese yuan. Now, this is a huge development as well. Nigeria being, despite all of the strife, despite Boko Haram, despite all of the different things happening in Nigeria, Nigeria is still one of the two or three, I guess you could say, economic drivers in Africa. Major economy, huge population, huge market for consumer goods and so forth. And this deal, we're talking billions, okay, to cut out the U.S. dollar is in effect to do exactly what the United States is trying to prevent. It is to make the United States irrelevant when it comes to this sort of economic arrangement. And this is the key. It's not just the purchasing of consumer goods, you know, from China into Nigeria and the selling of Nigerian oil to China. This actual relationship is now emerging in the opposite way. You now have consumer goods being manufactured in Nigeria being sold to an increasingly large Chinese consumer market. Okay, so now the kind of relationship that you're seeing is actually broadening out. It's no longer just a raw materials to finished products relationship. It's now, I guess you could call it a two-way street, so to speak. And this is, I think, a nightmare scenario for the United States. It's one of the reasons why, from my perspective, and I'm going to try to write on this in the coming weeks and months, from my perspective, this is one of the major reasons why you're going to see the situation in Nigeria heating up dramatically, Boko Haram, and much, much more. In many ways, I think Nigeria is one of the ticking time bombs of Africa, and the United States knows it, and I think that this is part of the reason why that country's in the crosshairs.
Yeah, I agree completely with that. And that is the nightmare scenario, the so-called win-win relationship, where you're seeing these countries' economies that's in an actual process of integration that doesn't involve keeping one side pauperized and shoveling raw materials and the others, you know, hanging out at the country club.
Yeah, and don't get me wrong, Nigerian oil and Chinese consumption of oil is still very much front and center. But again, I mean, China's importation of energy, they can get energy much more cheaply from other places. I don't think that China really looks at Nigeria and Nigerian oil, considering the route it has to take, the cost of transportation and so forth. That's not, I don't think that's the motivating factor for China here. I think China sees Nigeria just as Germany sees Nigeria, and that is a massive market, a huge market that is increasingly interested in things like everything from mobile phones to laptop computers, satellite communications, fashion, you know, textiles, all these sorts of goods. Are wanted in Nigeria, particularly in the large cities of the South. And that is, I think, what China sees in Nigeria, a desire for railroads, a desire for satellites, a desire for all of these things. And that debt settlement mechanism, what I mean is that currency issue, is really central to all of this. When you cut out the dollar, you now fundamentally change the calculus of a relationship.
Yeah, for sure, because now it's direct and not mediated.
Exactly.
And if you look at the same model, and we've discussed Venezuela. I just want to say about in Venezuela, they manufacture Chinese buses in Venezuela now. Venezuelans do it.
Yeah, exactly. And what I wanted to just interject, just so that nobody's confused about it, it's not the dollars themselves that are the only issue here. It's not being forced to go through U.S. and Western financial institutions.
That's right.
Debt settlement infrastructure, all of that is part of the global economic system that the United States is in many ways the architect of, the author of, right? So when you use dollars to settle your debts, you have to go through dollar institutions, Western banks and all of that. When you cut that out, you can actually go directly from Nigerian banks to Chinese banks. That is a powerful, powerful weapon.
Yeah, you're building the Chinese institutions and the Nigerian ones, too, by the way. And in addition to that, there's the aspect of control over the currency in terms of not having to have values readjusted by a third party. Because if a central bank decides to inflate or deflate a currency, that affects your transactions. And if that power is taken away from a third party, you have control over how to basically value your transactions.
That's right. And again, I mean, you hear a lot of talk about Chinese currency manipulation and keeping it artificially low. But if you and that's debatable, you know, it depends on how you want to look at it. Right. But if you think about it in the context of, say, the Nigeria-China relationship, yes, it means that, you know, large-scale Nigerian manufacturers are getting, you know, quote-unquote, less than they would get if they were being paid in U.S. dollars. But if you think about it in terms of affordability for Nigerian consumers, it's quite obvious why that would be advantageous.
And just to remind people, it was exactly the threat of an African currency backed by a gold dinar that Muammar Gaddafi posed to the U.S. right before the bombing started.
That's right. And remember that Gaddafi was interested in a form of economic integration using that model, and political integration using a United States of Africa model. Both of those things were really, I think, considered by the United States and, as we've seen in emails that have since been made public, France in particular, seeing that as a mortal threat to their influence and their hegemony in their former colonial territories.
And let's not forget Laurent Gbagbo either, because what he wanted to do was to print his own francs rather than have to use francs that were printed in Paris. And you see where that led him, straight to the docks at The Hague.
Yeah, exactly right. Breaking out of the architecture of the post-colonial colonialism, right? So the Francophone countries are still in many ways financially and economically enslaved by France. The Anglophone countries in many ways by both the British and the United States. And any attempts to break out of that, to change that relationship, have been met with either quote-unquote humanitarian intervention, humanitarian bombing, or various forms of quote-unquote international community intercession, such as you saw, as you mentioned, with Gbagbo.
Right. All right, so we have this playing out in Africa. We might as well talk about South Africa, then we can talk about Russia and India.
Yeah, well, in South Africa, in fact, it's a very similar scenario, and this is why I keep harping on this global perspective here, because South Africa, you know, and the African National Congress, the ANC, for all of its flaws, which are many, including corruption, including, you know, overstepping its authority, perhaps, and various other things. For all of that, and believe me, I've been a very harsh critic of the ANC from a more left perspective. With all of that being said, the ANC has moved very strongly towards a pro-China orientation, a pro-BRICS orientation, and going so far as to have Chinese investment not simply in the mining sector and in various other raw materials, but to have Chinese investment in education, Chinese investment in hospital building, Chinese investment in public housing, or at least Chinese funds being used towards that end. There has been a lot of push towards allowing China to be one of the principal, actually the principal economic partner. And so one of the things that I mentioned in my article has to do with the new head of the so-called Democratic Alliance, the DA, the much touted Obama of Africa, quote unquote, Maimane, who is actually pandering to U.S. economic and financial interests in the country, basically saying that if you have the DA take power in South Africa, we will ensure that the United States and the Europeans reassert themselves as the dominant economic player in South Africa. Because under the ANC, and particularly in the last few years, as the ANC has increasingly turned eastward, China has become statistically the number one trading partner for South Africa. And that is, I think, what the United States and its partners in Europe, what they see as the central problem in South Africa. So these protests, which to a large extent are valid, in particular, of course, the desire by students to get rid of these fees that were imposed on tuition, on university education. Obviously, the protests about housing and a lack of housing, the continued economic apartheid, all of these things, which are very legitimate, they have been used quite cynically by Western interests and their proxies inside of the country in order to orient the people away from the ANC and away from China. And in fact, to do what we were just talking about, to broaden that out further, it is in many ways similar to what you've seen over the last decade and a half in Zimbabwe, just the northern neighbor of South Africa, where you have a government that has moved towards land redistribution, that has moved to, with all of its flaws, with all of its corruption and so forth, that has moved towards a quote-unquote democratization of the economy. You have seen a Western-backed proxy political force in Zimbabwe, the so-called MDC, the Movement for Democratic Change, led by Morgan Tsvangirai, that has been talking about, dictatorship, corruption, all of the rest of these same tired old tactics to try to remove the government of Robert Mugabe. And that is the link between these two countries. And that is in many ways the broader question, the broader struggle throughout the continent.
So, looking at BRICS as a thing, and it's really not quite exactly that yet. It's more like a shadow of a thing, or an image coming into focus of a thing. But looking at it as a whole, you have a powerful economy in Latin America, Brazil. You have a good-sized market, highly educated population, and a nuclear umbrella, and apparently pretty skilled rapid strike forces in Russia. You have India with massive market and potential and manufacturing capacity, and China and South Africa, another large economy, this a member of the African Union. Russia hasn't been too inclined to get too involved in Africa, and China, of course, is engaging in this struggle with the West in Africa. What are the implications for China facing off against America alone in Africa?
Well, they're significant. Obviously, there's a lot of reasons why Russia has been reticent to get involved in Africa, not the least of which being Russia doesn't really have the kind of capital, the kind of money that China does as far as investing in Africa, nor does Russia have the same needs as China. Russia doesn't lust for raw materials the way that China does, that they don't need what Africa is providing in the way that China does. Russia obviously has its own oil, its own energy. Russia, to the extent that it needs it, has its own raw materials as far as in a mining sector, as far as in timber and other things like that. Russia's not really in need of what Africa's been providing. Also, I think that there is a hesitancy from Russia for a variety of reasons, both political and ideological and perhaps cultural as well, to not follow the path that the Soviet Union followed in the 1960s and the 1970s, especially, wherein it invested heavily in Africa for ideological reasons as a means of undermining the United States in the post-colonial period and fighting the Cold War. And I think that Russia's appetite for that has really waned. And I think that there's a lot of hesitancy on the part of the Kremlin to do that. And I think in many ways, they're quite wrong in that regard. I think that there's a lot to be gotten from fostering better relations throughout Africa. This is not to say that the Russians are, not interested in having diplomatic ties, but they haven't really invested political capital, let alone financial capital. And then obviously, Russia's own economic problems make it very, very difficult for them to do that now. But to get back to your question, the implications for China are significant. Look, China just opened its first real military facility in Africa in the nation of Djibouti. Really, I think strategically speaking, it's a means of guaranteeing China's continued access to the Bab al-Mandeb Strait, this critical choke point between Somalia and Yemen, opening up to the Red Sea, giving China access to countries like Sudan and Ethiopia also to an extent. Although Ethiopia and Eritrea, that conflict has made it difficult for Ethiopia to have any coastal access. But in any event, that I think has been a critical move by China, particularly in this tiny country, Djibouti, which has in many ways been seen in the last couple of decades as a more or less a military proxy of the United States, where the United States has been controlling the Bab al-Mandeb Strait, where the United States has been able, if it wanted to restrict access, to control access to that critical commercial waterway. And so China is, again, asserting not just its influence as far as an investor in China, it is beginning to assert itself as a political and military player. And this is, again, remember, it's right across the water from Yemen, where Saudi Arabia, backed by the United States, is waging a criminal war, where the U.S. CIA has been intimately involved. You have U.S. military forces all in that region, the Horn of Africa. So this is, I think, an example of how China has very quietly, but very, you know, loudly, at least in military circles, asserted and established a military foothold. Now, imagine what China could be doing in Africa if this were really a China-Russia alliance, a China-Russia alliance where military and economic investment could broaden throughout the African continent. You think that African countries are interested in looking at China from a purely economic perspective. Now imagine what they could do if they were looking at a China-Russia alliance.
You know, and at the same time, I'm a strategic planner for the Russian military or a strategic planner for China's military. And I'm looking at the encirclement of both countries, you know, the ongoing war games that at any moment could turn into an invasion, whatever. And obviously thinking that we should have some sort of a joint defense plan and military operations plans, et cetera. These things have to exist. And so looking at it through that, even if it's a theoretical view at the moment, you know, the placement of a Chinese military base in Africa is the placement of a Russian military base in Africa for some purposes.
Yes and no.
In a Confederate sense, almost.
I think that those of us who are interested in the distribution of global power for the purposes of peace would like to think that. I'm less convinced that that's really the case. I think that there is, for a lot of reasons, there is a residual mutual suspicion between Russia and China, especially on the military side. While, and in fact, there's sort of contradictions even in the context of that, because on the one hand, I think that there are military people in the military brass who are still very much suspicious of each other. But at the political level and the economic level, they're sharing some of the most advanced missile technology, the S-400s. The Russians have sent S-400 missiles to China. They're obviously developing some sort of a military if not a de facto alliance, then at the very least a more formal partnership. So yeah, I guess it's a yes and no in that regard, because on the one hand, there is that growing, you know, that direction that's being taken. On the other hand, I don't think that we can really say that, you know, and I know that you weren't suggesting it outright necessarily, but that a Chinese base is a Russian base, not quite yet. I think that they will, to whatever extent possible, benefit each other, but I don't see them as in the kind of alliance that's necessary. But, and to your point, Don, the potential that is there is the reason why the United States is pushing so hard for this military cooperation agreement with India. Because that agreement, which we talked about a few weeks ago, that agreement is really, I think, the center of how the United States wants to undermine the any potential for the kind of Confederate relationship that you're talking about emerging in BRICS. And there's a whole host of reasons why they want to do that. It's not obviously simply about Africa. It's also about Central Asia. It's about India providing a wedge to drive into the BRICS and the Shanghai Cooperation Organization to drive, from their perspective, hopefully, China and Iran further apart when it comes to a post-occupation Afghanistan, when it comes to the One Belt, One Road, when it comes to the former Soviet republics of Central Asia, when it comes to the India-Pakistan conflict, really kind of hitting on these key conflicts in the region that I think in many ways India provides that sort of fulcrum or what should we call it, platform for U.S. military power projection.
And you know, back in the days of the Red Menace, if you look back at what's happened, it obviously was clearly overstated as well, not just in terms of the relative economic strength of the two blocs and the denial of the fact that there were actually multiple blocs. You had not just China, but you saw how easily the Warsaw Pact countries fell off in the 1980s and 90s. But there's been a significant, almost like a shake the etch-a-sketch and draw a new picture, change in the global map. With the movement of those areas, for example, Central Asian republics, into one bloc, some of them, and the movement into this new rising bloc, the BRICS, of say, Brazil and South Africa. You know, from a geopolitical standpoint, from a military standpoint even, it's a different game. And then you have, in addition to that, the economic power of China, which, when you mention the S-400s, is interesting because Russia knows when we send an S-400 to China, they're going to have 10 times as many of them in about a month as we have because they have this tremendous productive capacity.
Well, yeah, although it's interesting, that question to me is always interesting because, you know, I've talked to a couple of people who are pretty knowledgeable on that issue, and they say that not so fast. They say that Chinese engineering capacity is obviously quite high, but in terms of the technical side of the S-400s, a lot of people are not convinced that the Chinese would be able to replicate it. And in fact, there is the open question of whether the Chinese can actually even operate it themselves or whether they need Russian engineers and Russian operators to really do that for them. I don't know, and I doubt that anybody can really say definitively because a lot of that is very much hush-hush. But so I'm not sure whether they can or they can't. Maybe they can over a long term period. But
yeah,
China's
with a month, of course.
Yeah, no, I know that. But I mean to say that China's military engineering capacity is really strong in some areas and weaker in others. And my guess, and this is just a guess, I'm not a military expert at all, but my guess is that their ability to really replicate large-scale missile systems is probably much further behind their ability to, say, build an aircraft carrier or an advanced oil rig or things like that.
They are doing heavy investment into space technology, for example. And
That's true. That's a good point.
This year is a very busy one for some very ambitious projects, including the second, they're going for a permanent space station. They're putting their second lab up. They're planning a trip to the moon. They got all kinds of things going on, and they're going to do a rendezvous this year in space too.
Yeah, that's true. And perhaps that dovetails in with their ability to build out, you know, these intercontinental ballistic missile systems, not only, you know, of the nuclear type, of course, but also the strategic defense systems such as S-400 and so forth. So, yeah, I mean, you have a good point. Maybe perhaps their abilities have gone much further in the last few years because of that space program. So, yeah, I think that's true.
All right, so And now we've brought ourselves to the point where we have 3 minutes to wrap it up. So how would you summarize?
Well, basically, you mentioned the encirclement of Russia and China. I think that that is really the central conflict here. Russia is facing very significant economic problems. China's economic slowdown. China's slowdown has forced them to scale back their investments in some places, both domestically and internationally. Obviously, One Belt, One Road, the New Silk Road, the Maritime Silk Road, all of these initiatives from China are really game changers for global geopolitics. Russia is very much involved in that. We talked about the Central Asian former Soviet republics. They're very much a central part of the One Belt, One Road. All of that in set against the things like the Trans-Pacific Partnership, TTIP, the free trade agreements, military confrontation or military provocation by the United States against Russia in the Baltic, which we saw just this week, against China in the South China Sea, which we've seen more of this week. I think this is really the center of this conflict, this economic integration process in the Eurasian space versus the military encirclement of the Eurasian space in the West and in the North against Russia and in the Far East against China. I think that that really, to break out of that, to break out of this containment strategy, that is the central mission for both Russia and China. And that, to me, to end this on a positive note, I would hope that Beijing and Moscow recognize the importance of having a global perspective in breaking out of that. If they could understand the importance of helping Latin America push back against this reactionary rightward push, if they could understand the, and hopefully they do, the importance of helping Africa push back against the creep of AFRICOM to force the Eastern European countries to turn away from NATO, to turn away from the United States, all of these moves, I think, would be the way that these countries push back against this attack on BRICS. The attack on BRICS is very real. The undermining and destabilization of these countries is one of the principal initiatives that the empire is pushing. Any way of pushing back against that, I think, needs to be welcomed, because the number one thing we have to be afraid of, the number one thing we should be concerned about, is global war. And it seems to me that's what the empire is driving at.
You know, and on that note, I just will tag that with the fact that when you mention Eastern Europe, for example, forgetting the political sensibilities of the people there, in fact, the placement of U.S. and NATO resources into those frontline countries means their de facto occupation, even if a good part of the military force is a domestic one.
Yeah, absolutely. And let's not forget, if we have a Hillary Clinton presidency, all of the conflicts that we just talked about will be exacerbated tenfold. And if we have a situation where the president of the United States, then the political establishment, is on a war footing, particularly with the unpopularity that Hillary Clinton has, we're looking at a moment of danger of world historical proportions, and I shudder at the thought.
On that note, Eric Dreitzer, thank you very much. A pleasure as always, and I've enjoyed doing this series with you.
Thanks a lot, Don. Always my pleasure.
You've been listening to CPR Sunday. I'm Don DeBar, your host, and look forward to seeing you again next week.